And good evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. It's been about a week since Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who is the son and namesake of the late overthrown dictator, was sworn in as the 17th president of the Philippines. Now, the incoming president takes office facing a slate of urgent issues, including rising consumer and energy prices, as well as needing to balance the competing superpowers, the relationship between competing superpowers, the US and China. Now, what can be learned of Marcos Jr.'s first few weeks in office that may preview the remainder of his term? Joining us from Quezon City is Aris Arugay. He is Professor of Political Science at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. He's also the Editor-in-Chief of the Asia Politics and Policy Journal. Aris, thank you for joining us tonight. Now, are there high expectations for Marcos Jr.'s administration? I mean, this in terms of what he can achieve versus what's been promised in you know, during the campaign. I guess I'm wondering whether everyone is kind of just waiting for him to set the tone in this first few weeks, with as opposed to perhaps giving him some time, a honeymoon period, to ease into office. What do you think?
Yeah, you're correct, Melissa. Philippine presidents are normally given a honeymoon period, but I think there's some extra sweet about the honeymoon period being extended to President Marcos Jr. Because first and foremost, he has received the biggest electoral mandate in terms of percentage of the vote since 1986. So since under this constitution of 1987, no president has actually gotten a majority share of the vote, given our plurality and multi-party system. So this is quite an astounding referendum or at least vote of the Filipino people, because he got almost around 59%, if I'm not mistaken, of the vote. This is around 31 million. But the honeymoon period that is supposed to be extended to him because of this extraordinary mandate needs to be juxtaposed with the not so fortuitous circumstances of the country and the world. And this somehow gives him a lot of challenges. Unlike his predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte entered the presidency with a large fiscal reserve, with good economic conditions, and with basically a well-run state by his then predecessor, President Aquino. Because of the pandemic, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, this clashing superpowers and uncertain strategic environment, the Marcos Jr. administration is beset with challenges, both domestic, regional, and I would say even global. So I do think that it has its work cut out for itself.
Okay, well, I'm guessing the economy will be the immediate priority here, particularly as you said, all those things, external factors playing into the domestic arena, a rising inflation coupled with soaring national debt. I'm wondering, Aris, what will you be watching out for to underscore confidence that the economy, that economic pressures are being properly addressed?
Well, there's a lot of policies that need to be implemented by the new administration, particularly in expanding the fiscal space needed to address the pandemic, to pump prime the economy, and to avoid the inflationary pressures and indeed even the threat of what economists called stagflation. While the Philippines has bounced back a little bit from the pandemic, even if it has the steepest decline across all ASEAN economies in 2020, that needs some form of confidence that the government is in charge, that the government is steering the wheel and is providing the needed policies to address the economic challenges. So I do think some prudence is also important, given that in order to create the fiscal space, you need to extract new revenues, but you also need to exercise responsible spending. And this is very important for the Marcos administration, for the Marcos family, who historically has not been fiscally prudent, I would say. So this is something that they would have to prove, that they are no longer the same family that ruled the country in the 1970s.
Well, can I ask you then, since you brought up in the beginning of our conversation that Marcos has this strong mandate through his landslide victory, I mean, those types of victories actually provide robust political capital for leaders to weather these types of economic headwinds. Do you think we will see him use that political capital to make those difficult economic decisions, to expand the fiscal space, to see fiscal discipline and perhaps even economic reform? Might he be brave enough to go beyond populist measures?
I do think that in his inaugural speech, in his inauguration address in last June 30th, he was able to give some hints that there might need to be some tough economic measures while still saying that the Filipino is strong and resilient, and it seems like he's preparing the Filipino public that tough times are ahead, and that he is asking for the entire society to be unified behind him in moving the country forward. So I think there might be, and some his economic managers are already hinting at new taxes, which will be tough because the Philippines, relative to other countries, have a very, relatively have very low tax effort. There might be a need to increase taxes that will harm middle class, lower middle class, those who are wage earners, and this has something to that is needed to be balanced. For example, with big corporations, of which a lot are very close to President Marcos Jr. and his administration. One fear is that there might be a return to crony capitalism, which might not be a good indication of confidence to the economy, of a level playing field. So in other words, there will be a lot of watchers for the measures that Marcos Jr. will implement. And I do think political capital is important, but it is not permanent. You could lose that political capital. So it is quite important to see the first 100 days because this will really determine what direction Marcos Jr. will put the country in.
Can I ask you about Rodrigo Duterte and his influence in the Philippines political sphere? Have we seen the end of the Duterte era, or are we still seeing this family have significant political capital? His daughter Sarah is now vice president. His son, I think one of his sons, mayor of Davao City, the other son in the House of Representatives. Are we going to be seeing Duterte still play a significant role in Philippine politics?
You know, in Philippine politics, nothing lasts forever except political dynasties. And the Marcos dynasty itself has shown this by coming full circle from being deposed in power in 1986 to being restored almost 36 years after. So while President Duterte himself, his influence might not wane, might wane in the coming years, but there's another Duterte, the second highest official, and it seems that Sara Duterte has somehow inherited the appeal, even the charisma and the ability of Rodrigo Duterte to somehow be able to still appeal to a lot of Filipinos. So I'm not counting the Duterte dynasty out because, one, they have a solid base in the South. I don't think that base will go for any other major dynasty or politician in the coming years, not even the Marcoses, I'm afraid. And this is why their combination is so potent, because Marcos comes from the North, Sara Duterte comes from the South, and this is the formula that led them to this unprecedented victory. So I do think that Duterte still has it. They're still, I think, learning, because, you know, at the end, their foray into national politics only started in 2016. But a dynasty can reinvigorate itself. And we've seen it with the Marcoses. So I'm not so doubtful that the Dutertes can do it as well.
All right, well, let's come to the issue of foreign policy. As we touched in the beginning, the Marcos administration will need to balance the competing superpowers of the US and China. Where do you think the Marcos administration will take foreign policy? Will there be closer relations to Beijing during this presidency, or are we going to be seeing traditional security allies, the US, have a stronger relationship with the Philippines?
Right. Every Philippine president, with the exception of Rodrigo Duterte, has in the preliminary phase of their presidencies strive to hedge, or to at least do this delicate balancing act between the United States and China, even if historically and even at present, the military alliance, treaty alliance with the United States somehow makes it difficult for the Philippines to really be center of these two competing superpowers. Unlike Rodrigo Duterte, President Marcos Jr. does not harbor negative ill feelings, despite somehow, let's remember that when they were deposed in 1986, they felt betrayed too by the United States, right? But I do think the United States knew about the history, knew the Marcoses, and this is why you have high-profile visits of officials. The second gentleman of the United States was in the inaugural of Marcos Jr. and high-profile visits, and Marcos Jr. himself has already been invited to the UN General Assembly in New York. Despite a court conviction in a U.S. court, so all of these seems to point out that the United States is ready to engage Marcos Jr. But let's not forget that the Marcos family also has cultivated very close and friendly relations with China over the years. Marcos Jr. was the one responsible for setting up a consulate in their home province in the north, something that the Dutertes were able to do in the south as well. And in the end, I think Marcos Jr. will not antagonize, something that Duterte was able to do, will not antagonize either powers. But I do think this delicate balancing act will give way to somehow a decision to be a little skewed or a little more partial to one superpower. But we won't see that anytime in the next year or so. And that will depend on how the US and China will make of their relationship with Marcos Jr. So it's a two-way street. But I do think that Marcos Jr. will strive to balance rather than antagonize one superpower over the other.
All right, thank you so much. That was Professor Aris Arugay. He is a political scientist at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We will be back with more on this topic. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hi, you're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Thank you so much for staying with us. Let's continue our conversation about what's in store for the Philippines with Ferdinand Marcos Jr. as its 17th president. Joining us now is Christian Asguera. He is a news anchor and podcast host based in the Philippines. He's also a resident fellow at the Research Center for Culture, Arts and Humanities at the University of Santo Tomas in Manila. Christian, welcome to the show. You host a podcast that looks at politics and governance in the Philippines. If I may begin our conversation today by asking you what you're watching closely in the Marcos Jr. administration in terms of indicators for governance issues, what do you think needs a close eye on?
Well, that is a very difficult question in the sense that we hardly know anything about the details of his plans if elected president, because we heard very little from him during the campaign. He actually missed most of the debates. He shunned most of the media interviews and basically just accommodated the so-called friendly reporters, celebrity bloggers for those particular interviews. So there are a lot of unknowns and uncertainties, one of which would be how he would deal with the media, especially given the experience of those who covered his campaign just a couple of months back. There was a lot of effort to basically not accommodate members of the mainstream press and just for him to provide his content on social media and his Facebook page, YouTube account, and make use of his celebrity supporters to get his idea across. So one thing as a journalist, I think this is a primary concern on my part. What kind of press freedom would there be under a Marcos Jr. administration, especially given our experience over the past 6 years with President Duterte, when a lot of civil liberties were constrained, to say the least, to be polite about it. And there was a lot of effort to actually control the critical press on the part of President Duterte. And to me, that provided a template for the next administration, in this case, Marcos Jr., to actually control the media as well. I don't think he would be as brazen, as crass as President Duterte, but I'm not sure whether it would be any different, because right now we're also already seeing signs of that kind of treatment from his administration. There's a lot of effort to basically control the conversation, the narrative, and to drown out the voices of those coming from news organizations or journalists who they consider are not too friendly to them.
Right. I do want to, if I may just quickly jump in there, Christian, I want to ask you about the crackdown on media, particularly the news site Rappler was ordered to shut down. We understand that they're appealing this decision, but because that happened before the inauguration, I'm just wondering if you're expecting the Marcos Jr. to undo the decision of his predecessor.
I don't exactly expect the new administration to undo that particular decision, especially since his administration considers Rappler as among those that are not friendly to him, his campaign and his administration. So I don't exactly expect that. If that happens, that would be a big surprise.
And what do you think might reverse, as you said that there's a template now for a crackdown on freedom of the press, what do you think might reverse this? Is there anything that might reverse this trajectory?
Well, I think it would, I'm not sure whether this would actually reverse it, but a big part of that has to do with how we, members of the independent press, would actually deal with this kind of crackdown. Again, I mentioned earlier that I don't think the new president would be as brazen as the previous one, but the effort to control the media would still be there, using a different means, and that is the use of trolls, disinformation machinery and infrastructure, which we saw especially during the campaign. My concern now specifically is how these agents of disinformation, especially now that they are the ones in government, would be actually used to drown out voices, not just those coming from media, but others who they consider as dissenters, when in fact they're just perhaps giving legitimate criticism about policy, about pronouncements, and seeking some kind of consistency. So this is one thing that I fear, and I'm very concerned about this, the effort to drown out independent voices.
Well, that does that jive with what he said in his inaugural speech, in his speech at his inauguration? I remember reading that he said he would seek to dialogue, seek and not scorn, to listen respectfully to dissenting voices. Do you think that indicates perhaps a tolerance for oppositional voices?
I would like to believe that, because I also pointed out in my previous episode, I think last week, I highlighted that particular portion. He said he would listen respectfully to those voices, right? And I would want that to happen, really. But if you look at the actuations, the behavior of people supporting him, including himself, there's a lot of inconsistencies that we are seeing. So it remains to be seen, especially since we know that there's this effort to use, again, this disinformation infrastructure or networks to stave off members of the legitimate press, the mainstream media. In my case, I also experienced this because I used to be part of the biggest network in the Philippines before the shutdown. That was ABS-CBN. And there was a lot of self-censorship happening then. And this was during the time of President Duterte. And I think a few weeks before the elections, I was removed from that company by the chief executive officer. You could feel there are a lot of stories and information that came that happened behind the scenes, but you would know that intense political pressure along with business interest actually played a big part of that. So that's the reality, and many news organizations and many journalists are also feeling this.
Right. Then may I ask, where is the space for civil liberties, for contrary views and oppositional voices? How would, say, civil society create that space if the media itself is being pressured to conform to a certain narrative?
Good thing that there's still social media. They can also still use that to their advantage, even if social media platforms, in particular, more than Facebook. I'm also looking at TikTok and YouTube in the Philippines, which are very much populated by these trolls, by these disinformation agents or purveyors. Civil society organizations, including members of the press, but also be there and try to populate even more those platforms. This is exactly what I've been doing. I decided to bring my journalism independently on YouTube in particular and other social media platforms. So, and I think recently, one of the longtime columnists of the Philippine Daily Inquirer, the English language broadsheet in the Philippines, it used to be the top one, the most influential, she was removed unceremoniously from that newspaper. And just a few days ago, she decided to open her own blog, her own website, and I spoke with her last night, and she's also planning to bring her articles on YouTube or her perspectives.
Right. You know, I do want to come back very quickly to the inauguration speech, because something in it, the talk about unity, the talk about, you know, needing to repair a house divided. I want to ask you, Christian, if you can give us a sense of is the Philippine society polarized, so polarized right now that there's so much talk about unity and coming together and repairing divisions? Could you give us some understanding as to where the sentiment on the ground is at the moment?
Definitely, there's a lot of discord, or the situation now in the Philippines is very polarized, especially even after the elections. And one funny thing is that officially, he was elected by 31 million Filipinos, officially. But you could sense the bitterness coming from the supporters of the winner. They're the ones who have been consistently initiating all this bashing, all this disinformation efforts on social media, which makes you think, who was the real winner here? Again, I still believe that he won, despite certain accounts, anecdotal evidence about cheating. I'm not convinced that cheating was so massive to actually affect the results of the presidential or the national elections. I don't believe that. But my point is, how come the winners are the ones who are bitter? That's one point. And number two, it's very funny because someone won using a well-funded narrative. Others called it myth-making, and called for unity, which was actually bought by his supporters, by majority of the voters. But I think there was a failure to acknowledge the fact that this was a figure, he was a figure, and he still is a figure who is very much polarizing because of his family's history and what they did to the Philippine economy and to Philippine society and other institutions That's why it boggles the mind. How come this was actually this was not exactly a big factor for a lot of those who voted for him? So it makes you think how big the role of disinformation efforts was during the campaign. And again, I'm not dismissing the choice of the majority of the voters. I would like to believe that many of them were not victimized by disinformation, but many of them were, right? Not most of them. And others also had their reasons. So this is this is very interesting, to say the least.
Christian Esguerra, the journalist based in the Philippines, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for this evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.